you've got these characters who just appear. They all need to have a beautifully designed costume and weapon and things like that. You know, even if they just appear for a fleeting moment, the viewer is going to spot if it's not up to scratch. That's the challenge with working on these big TV shows.
Welcome to another bonus episode of West of Westeros, Entertainment Weekly's Game of Thrones podcast. I'm Nick Romano, a senior writer here at EW, and our episode-by-episode coverage of House of the Dragon's premiere season may have concluded, but we still have some goodies left over. Today, I'm joined by Tim Lewis, the master armorer on House of the Dragon, who's responsible for making all the swords, shields, and other weapons on the series. He also happens to be the master armorer on The Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power, if that's something you care about. This interview was conducted fairly early on in the season for House of the Dragon, so there aren't too many spoilers past episode 3. Some of the topics we discuss include the making of the Valyrian steel blades, like Blackfyre, Darksister, and Viserys' dagger. We talk about specific props, like the spear presented to Viserys at the Royal Hunt by Jason Lannister, and also the hammer wielded by the crab feeder at the Stepstones. If you like to know how the sausage gets made, or what details you might have missed on the show, you won't want to skip this chat. Take a listen.
Have you been kind of keeping up with the episodes week to week, watching at home?
I have. I haven't watched this week, but I watched up to episode 3, which was probably one of our biggest episodes. So, yeah, just keeping an eye on all the weapons in that. And so, yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing this week's.
Yeah. Does it feel like a special moment to kind of like see all of your hard work kind of realized on screen? Or are you over it at this point?
It's always a mix, because you just spend your time looking for all of your stuff and errors and continuity things. So you're always constantly watching for your work. And so sometimes you lose track of the story. But actually, that was the nice thing about episode 2 for me, because I watched episode 1 at the premiere. And that was a lot of us because of the joust. Episode 2 didn't have any weapons or action, so I just got lost as a punter. I was like, "Yeah, I'm in this. This is great." And then back in on episode 3, it was all action. So yeah, it's nice to be in a project where you can just some weeks just sort of watch it as a punter, in a way, not as watching out for your work and being critical. So yeah, it's good.
Yeah. So how did you get pulled in to work on this project to begin with?
I'm trying to remember now how I did. I'm not sure. I don't remember who it was. Probably from the production. Hannah Godwin, I think she was the first person to get in touch with me. I can't remember how she got my number. I've done a lot of projects like this. So I think previous to this, to Dragons, I'd been on Ridley Scott's The Last Duel. So, and then, you know, almost my entire CV goes back, and it includes some sort of medieval battle fight stuff, a lot of that sort of period weapons. Yeah, I can't remember how I got involved, but I remember being asked to send in my portfolio to Ryan and Miguel. And funnily enough, I did a podcast for Ryan, because he does a podcast on prop collecting. And he said it wasn't until he looked at my CV and my portfolio online, it clicked. He went, "Man, we're actually making this project." Because, you know, before that, it's all the writing. It's all the, you know, trying to pull the finances in. But it's not until you say, "Oh, we're hiring a person who makes stuff," that it clicks, that it went, "Yeah, this is actually going ahead. This is happening. We're doing it." So it was kind of like funny to hear that from him, because you don't usually get to hear that from the showrunners or producers or anything. So it was, yeah. And Ryan's super into his weapons. So it's been a really fruitful relationship on that side. So yeah.
Yeah, I remember that podcast that you mentioned with you and Ryan. I remember thinking to myself, like, he's such a nerd for like all these props and all these weaponry, kind of like what you said. What was it like just having pre-production conversations with him about the direction, like, for these weapons? Was he like really involved in that process?
Yeah, him and Miguel, they were really keen, which was lovely. I remember my first proper meet, sit down meeting with them, I brought along a lot of weapons to sort of show them after I, you know, read the script and I just wanted to show them what I had to in stock. And they kind of looked through a lot of the stuff and went, yeah, that's totally Triarchy Pirates, or that's how we imagine, you know, Valerians, or so and so forth. So that moment was great, just to sort of get a grasp of what they wanted. And from then on, it was a case of me sitting down and doing the drawings and then liaising with them and discussing things. And each director as well, Greg, he was very interested in how the weapons could portray the story. He was doing a lot of the action episodes, the fight and things like that. So things like the crab feeder's hammer, he was really keen on that, because the character was written quite differently in the scripts. And actually, it sort of developed through these conversations. And and also he was involved in the lance in episode 3 at the hunt that gets given to King Viserys by the Lannisters. And he was sort of walking me through what he wanted this lance to be. And it wanted to be really, really gaudy and nasty and horrible. And I sort of went away and started drawing these things. And it just goes against the grain to draw things that aren't nice. It was really difficult. And he just sort of said, look, just imagine I'm this lord, and I've commanded you to do it like this. It's got to be dragon breathing fire, blah blah blah. And it can be well made, but it's not nice. And after, it was a sort of almost a role play moment between me and Greg, and just kind of what this eventual design was going to look like. I watched it last week, and you just go, I hope people get that it's supposed to be nasty, not very nice. You just. It's always a worry that you're kind of doing this thing that's, you know, just they're going to go, oh God, who designed that?
Well, it's interesting that you call it nasty, because like from when I first watched the episode, I was like, oh, this is a really cool lance. And it did kind of have a little bit of beauty to me. But like now thinking back to like my second or third viewing of that episode, I think I understand what you're saying. But are there like for the lance specifically, are there like certain specificities that you wanted to bring to that maybe like a casual viewer of the show wouldn't pick up on as being nasty, as you called it?
Well, it was just, I mean, I'd done a lot of different, in the script, I think it read it was a dragon breathing a flame of spear, effectively. And it was trying to depict something that felt medieval, but fantasy-esque. And sometimes you draw something and it feels too toy-like, almost, or too fantasy. And so I think we did do a sculpt and it felt big and clunky and possibly too toy-like. So I ended up doing a sort of medieval twist on it. And it was more the case of the materials we made it out of. So in the end, it was gold-plated and silver-plated. And so it was the fact that, you know, at the end of the day, a boar spear is supposed to be practical, is long, it's supposed to have these little prongs that keep a boar from sliding up the shaft. And actually, it was just, well, wasn't very what we made. We kind of want it to feel like it was thought that it could be practical, but actually it wasn't that practical. It was more beauty over practicality. But yeah, and then we've got there's the tassel section, and that's actually historically was supposed to stop the blood from going down the shaft of the lance. So that's why that's in there. And then you've got all these embroidered sections on the shaft as well, which kind of, you know, it's just all a little bit over the top. So yeah, hopefully that sort of comes across. But yeah,
you also mentioned the crab feeder's hammer, and I was curious if it was always in the scripts always meant to be a hammer, because it felt like a very specific weapon for this particular character.
Yeah, a script, like I think I said earlier, script wise the character was very different, and he became this sort of reclusive, nasty character, and it was going to be a sword. It sort of, I think it said in the script earlier on, it was a bejeweled sword he had, and that went against what Greg imagined. And he liked the idea of this hammer because he wanted to see the crab feeder literally hammering his enemies to the posts so the crabs could eat them. So that was part of the reason it being hammered. And then I just ended up putting a sort of meat masher side on the hammer part, and then a bladed section on the other. So it could be used in a battle setting. It's a shame we never really got to see him fight with it, but it could have been quite fun. But we see David bring that hammer back, I think, in one of the episodes, and throw it on the floor. And it just wanted to look a little bit like Greg was saying, it wanted to feel like he could have taken it from somewhere, like he's collected all this stuff and it was just something that he picked up and he doesn't really look after it. It's gone a little bit, not rusty, but it started to wear away and weather in the sea, seaside weather. So yeah, it was good. It was a good little project, that. And I think when I would be walking around the studio, when my guys would be walking around the studio at standbys with it, it would often garner a little bit of attention. And because it just looked a little bit nasty.
That seems like a common theme among these weapons, nasty weapons, almost.
Yeah, it is. It was. I'm trying to think back to some. I mean, we did a lot of swords, and we had a really amazing sword maker in Sweden called Peter Johnson, who's, he's written a lot of books. He's a very well-known historical sword expert, and he designed Blackfire and Dark Sister, which are the two sort of key props. And he was actually on before I came on. So Ryan had been in touch with him because Ryan was so keen to have these amazing swords. And when I came on board, I couldn't believe, Peter's doing stuff. That's really great news. You know, you can't get many people better than that to be doing it. So it was great to sort of then speak to him and be involved with working with him. And then from that, it kind of influenced the way I took the rest of the sword designs, really. And hopefully, you know, they all tie together. And with all these projects, you've got to sort of work in broad brushstrokes to begin with the armies, and try and, because you've got massive amounts of swords to make. So you've got to, in a very short amount of time, that's the thing with TV and film production. There's months to do it, and if you're making one sword, it can take 3 months to make a sword. So you've got to sort of work out how you're going to do it quickly. So with the armies specifically, that's the key ones you want to get designed and manufactured, so that they can be worked on whilst you're then working on all these other principles that play throughout. And the thing with House of Dragons is, unlike a film, you've got these characters who just appear for like maybe a quarter of an episode or half an episode or so. They all need to have a beautifully, well, hopefully beautifully designed costume and weapon and things like that. You know, even if they just appear for a fleeting moment, the viewer is going to spot if it's not up to scratch. So that's the challenge with working on these big TV shows. It's not like a film. There's so many different characters. Yeah. Mm.
I think it's so interesting what you say about how the design of Blackfire and Dark Sister kind of inspired how you designed all the other swords for the series. I mean, what were the biggest takeaways in your first conversations about, you know, what Blackfire and what Dark Sister would actually be realized on the screen?
Well, the designs hadn't been quite finalized when I came in, and it was, I think, Ryan had sort of told Peter, you know, some basic feelings, like the slenderness of Dark Sister, as opposed to Blackfire's more larger blade, which would be a more sort of kingly statement piece. And then going into all the detailing, like the I mean, to be honest, Peter just had literally cast the pommels in silver. You know, we would never do anything like that on a film. It's, you know, it was just all the detailed work that he did was just so intricate and beautiful. And so, you know, I, and in all honesty, these two swords are standout swords in the universe of Westeros. And so we were never trying to outdo that, but we wanted to fit in with that. And also, looking back at Game of Thrones, you know, you don't want to jump too heavily away from an established world that exists. So everything we did kind of hopefully harks into that world. And I'm very much of a style of manufacture which is authentic as well. And that's the same as Peter. It didn't want to feel like a fantasy sword. It wanted to feel like an authentic sword and how an authentic sword would have been made. You know, we think the same way. It's, you know, how would it have been done? It would have been, you know, carved in wax and then cast as a lost wax cast. And then the wooden handle would be made up and wrapped in leather and all these components would come together on the blade. And that's how we make our swords. So it wasn't too hard to kind of keep into that same world as Peter. Just playing with those designs and constantly going and chatting with Ryan and saying, hey, Ryan, what do you think of this? This is, this is for character such and such or whatever. It was great, great fun, amazing. And there's other characters like, you know, the Sea Snake as well, for Miguel and Ryan said that they wanted something really big and menacing because Steve, who plays the Sea Snake, is a big guy, and he's got a background, you know, the Sea Snake has a background. He's this sort of seafaring character who's been everywhere and had adventures, and so he needed to have something that stood out. And I went away and drew some really big swords but swords that were true to a historical bent, really. And also I drew some bardiches, which is what he eventually had. And Ryan and Miguel, I remember them sort of going, it looks a bit fantasy. And I literally pulled up some references of bardiche that were even more fantasy than what I'd drawn, and they went, "All right, there's precedent for that." And I think that was part of what they wanted, was not for things not to be too out there. It needed to feel like it came from a medieval time, because, like, I think one of their comments was, "There's dragons in this world, but you have to believe that there are dragons in this world by believing that everything else within the world, was authentic. You know, you don't want anything that's too fantastical. The only thing that's fantastical is these dragons." That was their feel on it. So I was trying very hard to keep everything as historically accurate as possible, but playing with design. So yeah, I did the bardiche, and I remember, you know, asking Greg, when are we, you know, trying to work out when we wear it first gets seen, and the first time you see it is when he comes over the sort of sandy mound on the beach with it in his hands, and he's swinging it in anchor. They were super pleased with that. And there's a sort of big axe side at the on one end, and then there's a big spiky ball on the other end, which he sort of swings to. Great effect, I think, and takes people out. But you know, all these characters, they have not just their big weapons, they've got all the daggers and knives as well. So it was just a case, you know, there was so much design to do. It kept us busy for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, were you also involved in the look of Viserys's dagger when you talk about all these other kind of weapons that are in the show?
That was interesting because I think quite early on, the guys said that they wanted it to be the cat's paw dagger from Game of Thrones. And we got a cat's paw dagger over from Ireland, from Legacy, and we had it there, and we took measurements, and we were allowed it for a couple of weeks. I can't remember how long now. It was all, you know, it's heavily guarded, came over in a Pelly case, and I had to sort of keep it locked up whilst it was with us. And we looked at it, and we sort of said, well, maybe we could just adjust it here. We don't want it to feel like, you know, it's directly the same thing. And also Paddy had to wear it all the time. It was always on him. And that was what he wanted to do as well. He was really key. That was partly one of his ways of defining his character. You know, it was always on him. So I went away and took the design. We reduced it slightly because he was going to have it all the time. We reduced its overall size and length. And then we just played with different ways of different designs. And what we went for in the end was the same silhouette. It's got I think it's like a dragon bone handle on it. And then the metalwork is the bit that's different. And there is a gem on there, which again goes into the Game of Thrones version of it. But we just thought the metalwork, and that could be something that could be altered or could have been, you know, damaged or something to become what it became in Game of Thrones. So we were never sort of trying to like go too far away. We wanted to feel like, well, you take the blade, you take the handle, you change the metalwork a bit, and it becomes that one from Game of Thrones. So it's the same thing, but like all things, they change through time. You know, it's hundreds of years. So yeah, that was our field. And the other thing was that was one of the you know, that and Dark Sister and Blackfyre are all Valyrian steel. Which is, I'm sure you know, is a Damascus effect, which or Woot's effect of steel. And we, whilst Peter himself used actual Damascus steel to make Blackfyre and Dark Sister, we didn't use it. We make most of our blades in an aluminium because it's lighter and it's you know, easier, because we make ours slightly thicker so we can make them in rubber, etc., etc. But so then that meant that we had to etch all of these Damascus effects into the aluminium, which meant that we would first come up with the design, then we would apply we would then draw that up on the computer, cut that out and a vinyl, lay the vinyls onto the blade, peel off each tiny little bit of highlight low light of the blade, and then that would then get etched in an acid, and then you would take that out. I mean, it took like ages to do one blade. It was, you know, you're just pulling all these vinyls off, and it's not until you finally take it out of the acid and then you clean it up and then you pull all the rest of the vinyl off to know if it's worked. And if it hasn't worked, you've wasted the entire, you know, time you spent making the blade and then trying to etch it. So that was a really big, long, arduous process. So, yeah, Valyrian steel is, the most arduous, of blades to make in the whole of Westeros. I can guarantee you that. So, it was, but I think that was one of the other things that Miguel specifically was keen to have was actual Valyrian steel look to these things. And for it to read on camera as well. So hopefully that does come across, that you can see that these things are actually, you know, look like they are what they're supposed to be.
Yeah, no, I think it absolutely does. And we also kind of learn in the context of the show that if you heat up Viserys's dagger, you can see all these High Valyrian glyphs about, you know, Aegon's prophecy. I mean, did you also have to design that blade with all those etchings in it, or was that kind of visual effects laid in after the fact?
Thankfully, I didn't. It was all the visual effects world, which was no. What we did have to do was to supply a knife that would go into that fire. And the knife that we actually made would not survive going in that fire originally, because it's the handle itself is a form of plastic. So we ended up making plaster ones. So that's that knife you see in there is actually a plaster version, which we artworked up, and then it's visual effects take over. So that was actually, whilst it seems like a really innocuous, easy part of the filming to do, just stick the knife in a fire. That's what, you know, knives can do. It was actually, it took a little bit of thinking about. So yeah, that was, but yeah, we didn't, that went into the art department and the visual effects department to create all the glyphs. Yeah.
Another dagger that I just, my eyes immediately went to when I was watching this show is the one that Lord Corlys carries around with him, and the hilt of it, it looks like a mollusk just kind of open with like a little pearl in the middle. That was so cool. What was the process like designing that one and actually making it?
So that's probably one of those, that and Damon's knives are probably my favorite of the you know, items we made. And the Corlys's knife is it started off, they're basically like I was looking at 16th century ear daggers, Italian ear daggers, which have this sort of ears effectively on the pommel, right where you were saying they're like a mollusk. And I just went, do you know what, it's, he's the sea snake, he's traveled the seas, let's introduce some form of oceanic feel to it. But then if you look inside that pommel, there is a movable section. So it's quite hard to describe, but on the inside of the ears are the basically a kind of map, and my idea was that it was a form of astrolabe, which is a medieval way of helping you to work out where you are, navigation when you're at sea. The inside has got all these lines which tell you this, line up the stars or something like that, you know, that you would then turn the centerpiece in the middle of the dagger, which actually turns, which has got Valyrian runes on, which would effectively give you a northeast southwest, and you would then be able to use that knife pommel to navigate your way at sea. So probably not many people know that, so it's a small piece, but it helped, you know, it's little elements like that which help the actor get into the character. I think it's just taking those pieces of the character and weaving a story, and so that's where I think it's really important to get into your design is those elements. So yeah, it's got this mollusk like sea shells on it. The blade itself is quite wispy and curvy, and actually some of the leather work, the sheath that it's in, it also have that sort of it's got leather carving which have got sort of sea elements, ocean elements. So yeah, it was a really satisfying piece when it came together. And again, the Damon dagger, it was, once I'd sort of gone down this ear dagger route, I liked it when I played on that. And Damon's is again an ear dagger, and but his has got a sort of dragon's egg in the center, and then it's got these sort of shell ears on the side. Yeah, it was it was, yeah, they were really nice pieces. And then also Damon's little knife that he's got. There's, so we made Damon's knife, and then on the camera tests, we put Dark's sister on, and we put the belt on, because we do all the belts as well, and all the buckles, and we put the knife on. And then he was just sort of, he's an actor who likes to do things with his hands. And so he was sort of saying, can I have something, just something that maybe this knife's too big, but can I have another one that's like a little, like a prison shank, sort of small little, okay, yeah, sure. So we went away and we did this little sort of, it's quite, you don't really notice it on there, but it's a really small little blade, a little small handle, and an ostrich skin pouch. And he just felt that was his character. It was just this little nasty little, yeah, prison shank thing. So he had that all the time on, as well as his other knife. And they just sat next to each other. And it's little things like that. You've got to let sometimes the actors feed you. You know, what do you, you know, I can say, you know, we've done this dagger to help you get your character, but what do you want from us? You know, we can give you whatever you want within reason. So that was nice, a two-way sort of relationship, that actor maker build.
Are there any other examples like that that stick out in your mind when an actor came to you and asked you to make something?
The only one I can say is Emily, who plays Rhaenys. I sort of pointed out that none of the female characters really have weapons. Rhaenyra does. She has a little hunt dagger in episode 3. But no, and for obvious reasons, because, you know, that's part of the story. It's, you know, the female characters and their battleground is the bed, etc. You know, all that. But she, I remember Miguel saying, "Would you, you know, you want a weapon like that?" And she went, "Yeah, I want a weapon." And he went, "Well, you can have a diamond tipped whip." And they just looked at me. I was like, "Oh, okay, all right, a diamond tipped whip it is then." So we went away and we did make up some whips. But actually, Emily, I think she had a bit of training, but it never got used in the end. It kind of didn't work. It didn't fit in any part of the shoot. So, which was a shame. With Rhys Evans, Otto Hightower, we made a number of daggers, and his character doesn't feel like a particularly armed character most of the time, but I think in some of the episodes coming up, he, after a certain point, he does get a knife or a dagger. And so I kind of wanted him to have that choice of what it was. So we kind of made it, you know, almost like a shop, you know, which one do you like? So he came in and got to sort of choose which one he thought the character would have. But other than that, it was... you know, always, I mean, for some of the guys who've never done a medieval show or anything like that before, or, you know, they start coming along to fittings and then they get dressed up in all this armor or whatever. And suddenly they've got their own sword and they just, you know, turn to kids. It's quite, quite funny to watch that. So, trying to make sure they don't take the ceiling down with their sword as soon as they've been, give it, put on their costume. So, yeah, and some of them are super experienced and they've been through it all and they've seen that they've had their own weapons before. And it's funny sometimes the newcomers are like, yeah, can I have a knife and a sword and a blah blah blah, blah and all this and that, and the more experienced ones are saying, oh no, I'm happy with it, just this, and then couple of weeks into shooting, they realize that they didn't want to have all the stuff because they've got to carry it around all the time. And it's really, you know, it can get heavy and they're like, yes, that's why they didn't ask for everything. It was, But there weren't too many more actor requests.
We're going to take a quick break, but when we return, we'll continue our conversation with Tim Lewis. Stay tuned. Welcome back to West of Westeros, where we're currently in a conversation with Tim Lewis, Master Armorer on House of the Dragon.
I remember being on set with you guys around episode 8, I believe it was, at Leavesden Studios. And I you know, was able to chat with Miguel for a little bit. And he had mentioned that you guys went through kind of like a sword shortage at one point, at least in terms of the design for the Iron Throne. And he kind of mentioned that he had to kind of pull swords from like all these other productions. But I was wondering if that sword shortage kind of hit your department at all.
It was less of a sword shortage. A sword shortage. It was basically, there are a lot of blades in that throne. And we were sharing the workshop with the prop makers who were working on the throne. And I know that, we were discussing it all the time. And I have a load of molds and a load of blades. So I gave them my molds to cast swords from. So they would be casting a lot of their swords in plastics and things. So they were able to mount those onto the throne. And then we also manufactured lots of metal swords for them, metal blades. And the thing was is that we were just looking around for generic blades that you could buy off the shelf. And Pete, who is currently working with me, actually, who is heading up the prop making side, we pointed him in the direction of this company that makes cheap swords, blades from, and they basically bought up lots of stock. And part of that that you can buy from them were swords from other films. So it was too tempting just to kind of say, oh, maybe we'll just stick a sting in there or something like that. You know, there are a few, it wasn't me who put it together, but I know, you know, there are quite a lot of those blades that were put in to make up the numbers. And it's the blades of the enemies, isn't it? So it was quite fun to do that. And to have a mix, because that number of blades is just, it's difficult to make it not appear like the same sword over and over and over again. So it's just a variation.
Do you know how many, even like if you have like a ballpark number, like how many swords you were kind of working with at any given time?
That I was working with, or rather the throne?
Or that you were working with?
That I was working with. We had the Stepstones battle, we had 165 Valyrian soldiers and Westerosi soldiers versus 165 Triarchi. So we had 330 extras or stuntmen at that time. So we kitted up, you know, 330 there. And you've got to have more than that in stock because they damage them as they go. So, you know, you could just say, well, there's 400 there. Not just that, you've got the shields, scabbards, belts to get for them as well. Axes, things like that. So, and then the joust as well. We've got all of those swords. So, I mean, I'm trying to think now. There's at a guess, I don't know, maybe we had 500 or something like that. We could have got into that because every character we do, whilst we make three hero swords, we also make at least 6 rubber swords. So for each character, there'll be 9 to 10 swords. And we'd have 3 scabbards and 3 belts. And so, 500 easily, I'd say, if not more. And Lances and Breakaway Lance, I mean, we did for the Joust, funnily enough, because I'd done the last duel, the job before, we'd done the Joust in that, or the duel in that sequence. So we'd been sort of researching and designing how we could do that. And so we knew how we could achieve it. And so we had the knowledge of how we could implement it before we went into this job. Funnily enough, thinking at the end of the last year, well, that's the last time I'm going to do a joust in a long while. And we ended up, you know, cutting up a lot of molds and things that we could use. And then suddenly the next job, oh yeah, it's a joust. So we've got help. Yeah, it was a bit of a surprise. So yeah, we ended up making 250 breakaway lances, if not 300. And each one of those, you know, was filled with debris so that on impact it looked like it was exploding everywhere. So, you know, it was mass production for these things. And also we did a lot of breakaway shields in that. There's the Cole versus Damon fight in that sequence. Because we get so used to seeing things done in visual effects, people assume, well, it's all done in visual effects. And a lot of us who work in the industry, we want to do it for real. We want to do it practically. And so hopefully you can see that it's a practical, all these things are done practically, the breakaway lances and the breakaway shields, and they're not just something that's been added in post. Because I think that's really important. And I think the guys, you know, Ryan and Miguel and all the others felt that as well. They want to do filmmaking how filmmaking was. You know, there are a lot of visual effects in House of the Dragons, but, you know, it doesn't mean they all have to be. So hopefully, you know, we kind of added to that. And we did also do a lot of wax maces and wax axes, which are hollow wax-headed axes and maces, which we filled with blood and then put the handle in. And so as soon as we hit a stuntman with it, it just explodes and it just looks like their head's been obliterated effectively. Which, I mean, it really is childish, but it's so fun. It's when we were doing all the research on that, you know, you just hand it, there's footage of us just playing with it, and it's just it's a real fine line between making something that's going to work for its given purpose and hurting the person who it's being done to. So it was really fun. And I hope that gets you pick that up on in the footage that you guys get to see, or that everyone gets to see. So yeah.
I'm curious what you have to do to kind of maintain a lot of these weapons, especially like when we think about Blackfyre and Dark Sister, just like knowing, you know, like most of the famous Game of Thrones props end up like going on display somewhere at some point. It's like, so what do you have to do for like these kind of core weapons?
Once everything's manufactured, that's just half the job. It's the, you know, the rest is making sure everything's in the right place at the right time on whatever unit it's supposed to be filming on, and making sure it gets there without getting damaged. So like the rest of the shoot, everything's, you know, on tech trucks. So we're shipping things around in boxes on special made shelves, transporting it from A to B. We would take, for example, Damon's kit. Damon's kit would all be kept in some large Pelly cases most of the time, and you would maybe have the three hero versions of it. So the one that Peter made, which was the real steel one, that usually was sort of in its own little special box and only came out for special occasions. And then we made three more in aluminium, which I think you probably would struggle to sort of tell the difference between them. And they would all be kept together or be split for different units. And then we would also have the rubber versions and then all the belts. So you try and keeping this kit together in boxes so that you can just lift the box, take it to set, so that we can dress it on people, and they're all named, so you can easily spot them all. And then every now and then you might have to clean up the swords, or you might want to dirty them down, you know, dictated to by the script how you're treating them and how they turn up on set, how their art worked. And then we also have all the rubbers, and so when you're fighting, they get damaged due to the very nature. The ideal sword for a stuntman is one that's super soft, but really rigid, and so the two things don't go together. So you have a sort of 50-50 halfway house, so that if they crack their knuckles or something, it doesn't hurt too much, but doesn't fall apart or doesn't rip as soon as you start hitting it something else. So they do get damaged, and so it's up to us to try and make sure that we keep them going for as long as they possibly can. So that's half the challenge of being on set, and you can often see an armor just running around quickly gluing bits back together and spraying something up and trying to make it look perfect before the next one gets broken, and then run it back onto set. But that's part of the challenge. I'm trying to think of any other ways we look after things. It's mixed. It really depends on what you're turning up to on a specific day, because some days a standby can just be looking after one dagger on a set with a whole load of people talking around a table, and other days it's 330 people going at each other, hammer and tongs. It's those differences is in what you're shooting that make it exciting, and it's never the same day twice. So that's part of the reason why we do what we do.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on all your work. I think it's really paid off from what I've seen. I've seen up to episode 6 at this point.
Yeah.
It's been great.
Good. Oh, I'm glad you're enjoying it. I'm glad you're enjoying it.
Well, thank you so much, Tim. I really appreciate you taking the time today to speak with me about all this. It's really been a treat.
It's a pleasure.
And that's it for this episode of West of Westeros. If you liked what you heard, follow, rate the podcast, and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. To keep the conversation going, follow Entertainment Weekly on all socials, at EW on Twitter, and at Entertainment Weekly everywhere else. You can also tag us at Nick A. Romano and at Morglar.
This episode of West of Westeros is hosted by Nick Romano and Lauren Morgan. Produced by Chanel Johnson, Sammy Junio, Nick Romano, and Lauren Morgan. Edited by Michael Classic. Full episode transcripts are available at EW.com.
New episodes of West of Westeros come every Sunday, right after the episodes of House of the Dragon air on HBO and stream on HBO Max. Stay tuned.